This is Harv Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast, and when I start my workday, it always begins with that morning shower. Normally, I use a liquid body wash, but recently I purchased a bar of Sterling Soap Company's handcrafted bath soap and decided to give their Deep Blue Sea handcrafted bath soap a try. Immediately, the aroma of Sterling's bath soap was obvious, and in using this soap, I felt refreshed, clean, energized, and Sterling's bath soap helped me step out of that shower with the momentum and eagerness to get my day rolling. If you want to get a refreshing wake-up call in the morning and get your busy day off to the right start, I highly recommend going to Sterling Soap Company's website and order one of their many varieties of bath soaps among other products they offer. Visit Sterling Soap Company at sterlingsoap.com. That's STIRLINGsoap.com.
Stretch by Torres, the set, the kick, and the fence. It's deep to left field. This one may be off the wall, maybe in the screen.
Lang and Chernyshev on top as expected. They're eligible for Salt Lake City.
To Indian All-Star.
There we go. All right, Bill Black with Indian All-Stars podcast here. It's my pleasure to speak with today multi-award winning sports writer and author Lou Friedman. Lou, welcome to Indian All-Stars.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be aboard.
I would love to talk to you about your book, one of the, actually, the only one that I found so far that talks about Cherokee baseball player, Hall of Fame pitcher, Early Winn, and the 1959 Chicago White Sox. I actually have my copy of the book right here. Whoops.
There we go.
Fading in and out of the...
There's my copy.
Hey, look at that. We're twins. So you're a prolific sports writer, prolific author. Why did you pick the 59 White Sox and Early Winn? What about that made you...
It's not a hard and fast way ideas come to you. But in this instance... I can't hide my age. I'm old. So the 1959 World Series was the first one I ever followed on television as a kid.
Okay.
At 8 years old.
All right.
And I remembered so much about it, you know, the Dodgers, the White Sox and all that. Mm-hmm. And I moved to Chicago and was writing about the White Sox and doing projects researching the White Sox. So the two of those things are linked, you know, sort of in the deep recesses of my memory, thinking back to the good old days of 1959, just as a kid of, I can still right now even picture what the Dodgers were playing in the Coliseum because they hadn't built Chavez Ravine yet.
Okay.
And they had that short outfield fence and left field, and I mean it was a huge ballpark, but it wasn't a ballpark. It was built
right
for, you know, the Olympics in the 30s.
Right, but in field any case, massive, left field short. Yeah.
But I was because I grew up in Boston, I was basically an American League fan, so I was rooting for the White Sox even though they didn't win. But I also, as I, you know, as time passed and I got older and followed baseball history, read up on it and everything, there were several guys on that White Sox team that I enjoyed. Early Wynn was one of them. I never met the man. He had passed away by the time I had done this project. Mm-hmm. But I was always intrigued by his career. And especially it was my interest was piqued because of the 1959 season, which was properly his best. He won 22 games. He won the Cy Young Award. Right. He was the leading thrower on that White Sox team. You know, he's the guy.
Yeah,
that
39, 40 years old. That's an amazing accomplishment. Yeah.
Yeah. And he won 22 games. He was great that year, you know, and I was always, as simple as this sound, my name was Lou, and I was a Luis Aparicio fan.
Oh, hey, yeah.
That, again, when you're a kid, you latch on to things for different reasons.
Whatever connection you have, yeah.
Yeah, and that's so awesome. And Nellie Fox was on that team, another future Hall of Famer. But as I spent some time, you know, living in Chicago and writing about the White Sox, some of those guys would appear on the scene, like they might just come to a game or be in the press box or be in the dining room or something, and you get a chance occasionally to meet with them and talk to them. So that's probably a combination of, and plus I always remembered that Early Wynn's pursuit of the 300th victory was this ordeal. Unfortunately, he had been so great, and then he was and he was older, and he was so close, and he knew, and we knew he had to get the 300th win, and he tried so hard for so long, and it was so close, and he was missing out, and then he finally did it, and if you look at his all-time lifetime record, he retired with exactly 300 wins.
Exactly,
he got the 300th. Yep. You know, so I was always happy about that. And even in, and now as, you know, perspective as a much older adult, I'm so happy he got it, you know, because there were times in baseball history where stats didn't mean the same as they do now. Mm-hmm. And guys came close to certain landmarks. I mean, if you look, and this is a different kind of situation, but, you know, Lou Gehrig, of course, was infamously faded out abruptly from his illness.
Right.
When he was his last year where he suited up at all for the Yankees. And if you look at his lifetime record, it was like he had 493 home runs, not 500. And he had 1,995 runs batted in, not 2,000. That was because of the illness, but you kind of keep, you kind of inwardly wish, oh, another couple weeks, you know?
Yeah, boy.
He'd done it. So, but Early Wynn did it. He persevered and did it and got that 300th. And I was always happy for that. Even though this was all going on as a kid, I always remembered it.
Sure.
So being in Chicago, Chicagoland, being around the White Sox more, much, much more, you know, and going to the park. And they weren't drawing that well. So if you were there, it was looser, you know. And unfortunately, since this book came out, a lot of those older guys have passed away.
Right.
So I was fortunate to be able to talk to them and interview them when I did. You know, a surprising number. It's just one of those things that happens sometimes. And it's the passage of time, because obviously if you were in your prime baseball years in 1959, you know, eventually you're going to be in your 80s.
Anymore,
when you're in your 80s, more guys are likely to pass away.
Right.
So I was an Early Wynn fan. And because of the research I did, I really learned a lot more about him during the fabulous stages of his career with the Cleveland Indians.
And
that's where he really shined, even though it was more personal with the White Sox than Chicago because of the nature of this. You know, in his own life, you know, when he was one of the best guys in the league for a long time, it was all representing Cleveland.
Sure.
So, you know.
Well, and that's something that I want to get into a bit, talk about his career and you know, how prolific and how you know, pretty dominant he was. Because through the passage of time and everything, kind of lose sight of of that impact, you know?
Absolutely, that happens.
Yeah.
And he is one of those guys that it's happened to. I mean, 300 wins, as we know now, the way baseball is constituted, nobody's going to get there again.
No.
I mean, nobody's close.
Yeah.
And nobody, I mean, there was a lot of talk in the last couple of years about Justin Verlander, but Justin, as much as I love Justin Verlander, and he is a Hall of Famer, he's still only like around 250 wins, and he's 40-something.
Right.
He's not going to get there.
Not.
And he hasn't even been healthy.
Yeah.
I mean, when the last time somebody brought it up to me, I said, you know, he's 40 years old, and he still has to win 15 games a year for like 4 more years. And then he probably got hurt and only won like about 3 games that year. So it's just not going to happen.
No.
I miss that. I lament that. But reality is such, you know, this is a very exclusive club. I believe there's 24 people who've won 300 games. I'm not, if that's accurate, it's right about that. So Early Wynn is one of those all-timers.
Right. Yeah. And again, a name that has kind of faded away, but shouldn't be. And that's
absolutely. And the funny, you know, All-Stars thing is, he wasn't one of those guys, I think, who was a chatty guy around the locker room. He was a gruff guy. And some of his most memorable phrases, you know, if you're a baseball researcher, and I am one, and I read a lot of baseball history, and as well as writing a lot of baseball history, as you know, I mean, sometimes you can just read some of his things and laugh out loud, because and they stick. He's the one who said, you know, and it always stuck to him, that if his mother, there's variations on the theme, but if his mother was crowding the plate, he'd brush her back or hit her with a pitch.
Right.
And sometimes he came across as a grandmother, whatever. And I was just rereading. I have a little passage in the book where it talks about where somebody asked him, would you throw a pitch at your mother on Mother's Day? And he said, if she was crowding the plate, I would. You got to love that. You know, that flavor.
Yeah.
I mean, so if you're going to be labeled mean because of that, but, you know, people didn't really take that seriously. But it was I'm sure that the cluster of reporters around his locker room on the day he said it first, and I think he said it more than once. That's one from my research. That's why I think I've seen it attributed to him, with him saying about a mother and a grandmother, but that they must have been laughing aloud that day.
However, it sounded in print,
but you got to think when the guys were listening, they were all chuckling.
Sure.
Yeah. So rather than say he's a geek, but he was one of those guys who's, there were certain pitchers. Bob Gibson had that image, right? You know, I own the plate.
Right.
If you're in the way, it's your tough luck. Yeah, and Early Wynn was just like that. You know,
the quote that I have in the poster in the background there talks about that the 17 inches are, that's my office. And you don't come in my office without an invitation. So
that's right. And those guys wanted to protect their territory.
Yeah.
And they knew that's how, what they had to do to succeed.
Yeah. And that was, you know, that was the way that the game was then. The batters knew that
too. Exactly. Nobody was whining about it.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No.
You're going to crowd it. You're going to take your lumps. So
that's your risk if you're stepping over the line.
That's it. Yeah.
And it wasn't. And you know that those guys loved it. Guys like Bob Gibson and Early Wynn, because they knew it worked to their mental advantage.
Right.
It gave them the psychological advantage. If he encroached on Early Wynn's territory with his toe, he was going to get plunked. That's the risk he took.
Yep. Yep. You know. The second time up, he's going to be thinking twice about it. So, yeah.
Right. Yeah. So he was good at that. But he won a ton of games.
Yeah.
Again, more of them with Cleveland than with the White Sox. This was the end of his career. And partially, as you mentioned earlier, when he won those 22 games, he was in a tail end. You know, it was a guy winning 22 games at pushing 40
Yeah.
It was quite the achievement. I can think of Warren Spahn as someone who was over 40 and won over 20, but not too many guys.
Not many. Well, heck, not many guys make it over 40 in the first place.
Well, so. And then not these days, of course, winning 20, nobody pitches long enough.
Right. Yeah.
You know, just, in fact, just today, I read the box scores from last night's game. One pitcher in the majors did pitch eight innings yesterday.
No way. Wow.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
If it's you unheard of.
Never mind a complete game. But it's like, you know, and the day before, somebody was pitching a one-hit shutout, and they took him out after seven. You know, it's just the way.
Guys rolling and just on a pitch count. You're done. What? Yeah, that kind of messes with the game, doesn't it? I mean,
I think Nathan Eovaldi pitched a complete game for Texas 2 days ago. Four-hit shutout, I think. But he only threw 92 pitches.
Wow.
They likened it to Greg Maddux in the story. I mean, but that shows how rare.
Yeah.
This is an everyday thing that we grew up with. So.
Yeah. Guys going out pitching complete games. Back in the day, guys had pitched two complete game doubleheaders. I mean, it's, you know, a long time ago, but not right. Today's world.
No, I can imagine in those kinds of circumstances, early win being on the mound and a manager coming out and he'd be saying, "What are you doing here?
Yeah, exactly.
You're not taking the ball from me for this. Are you crazy?" Yeah, I mean, that was so. I mean, I don't know that that ever happened, but I could certainly envision it.
Well,
his likelihood with his personality and the mentality of the game, you know,
right.
Somebody had tried to take the ball away in the eighth inning when he's thrown a shutout.
Are you kidding me? Get out of here. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
So
he was an integral member of that team, that 1959 team. And they wouldn't have won if had it without him. No question.
They had a lot of like blue collar workman guys on that team. That a couple Hall of Famers, right? But the majority of the team was, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna say also-rans or cast-offs from other teams, but when they assembled that team, there were a lot of middle-of-the-road guys that really came together, and I thought that was really pretty cool.
Very much so. I mean, except for the middle infield with Louis Aparicio and Nellie Fox, both Hall of Famers. And they had a special bond. I was working in Chicago, and I was at the event when they unveiled when statues at the ballpark at Comiskey became a regular thing. They have a lot of them there, but the day that they unveiled the statue, and it was a double play, not an individual statue of Aparicio and Nellie Fox together. Now, Nellie Fox died young from cancer. He was in his 40s, so he was not there, but Louis Aparicio practically never came back and made public appearances. Of that team, he's still alive. He's well into his 80s, but he's always in Venezuela. You know? I mean, he would never come back and make a appearance. But for that event, he was there, involved, open and accessible, and it was a treat to be able to talk to him about their relationship and that, because he felt so strongly about it and was so appreciative of the fact that the statue included the two of them together.
Sure.
Because that's how they were. And you don't see that very often, because usually it's an individual statue at a ballpark honoring somebody. But this was actually a double play statue.
That's really cool.
It really was. And like I said, it was also, boy, just about the only time I can remember Louis being back and chatty, because he was reticent and reserved. But I didn't know that it was a one-off until a little later.
But time goes on, amazing.
Well, I found out somewhat after that, but I mean, he had an agent, and the guy says, just because he talked to everybody today doesn't mean he's going to do it again, you know, and I don't know if he ever did it again.
Huh.
So, but that day was special for a lot of people, and it was a neat event when they had something. So that was something that memorialized this particular team as well.
Sure.
But so, when you talk, I mean, Early Wynn is more likely to have a statue of him in Cleveland.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually.
So as you were doing your research, and I want to touch a little bit on your process and your experience there, but what was something that stuck out to you about Early Wynn as you were digging through all of the information that you came across? What was something that surprised you, I guess?
I guess, well, I don't know if surprise is the right word, but the main source was the files on him at the Baseball Hall of Fame, you know, with the clippings from his heyday, from his playing days. And that's really what provided the background. I mean, he's from Alabama. He had a very hard scrabble upbringing. Mm-hmm. That was something that's mentioned in the book, is he thought he was going to be a football player. Then he broke his leg and emphasized baseball more. And he said breaking his leg was about the best thing that ever happened to him, because it pushed him more into pitching than baseball, which became his livelihood and way out of poverty, national fame.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, when you talk to athletes, sometimes some of these guys are just so good athletically, they probably could have played everything. I mean, you read about them sometimes, you go, and it just refers to them like, oh, when he was in high school, he was all state in this and all state in that. And he was an All-American in college in this sport. And you didn't even know about the fact that they did that.
Right.
And for them, it was like just a byproduct of them being naturally gifted, you know, and they could apply their athletic skills, you know, because you know them as a baseball player.
Right.
I mean, yeah. So, I mean, so he switched from football to baseball. And you know, he was living in, it was tough circumstances in small town Alabama. And that paved the way for him to go on and move up. And the rest of it was proving himself, which he had the skill and the talent and the fastball. You know, and that's it. I mean, he won a lot of games for the Indians in the 50s. It's so weird how overlooked the 1954 Indians team was for a number of super talented guys on it, because they got upset by the Giants in the World Series. You know, they were a super team with the regular season. And there are Hall of Famers galore on that team. Al Rosen, Bob Lemon. I mean, Larry Doby was on that team.
Yeah.
I mean, they just had so many guys, and they had an unbelievable pitching staff. I don't know how they lost four straight in the World Series. I mean, it just is. I mean, I was 3 years old or whatever, so I didn't see it. But yeah, when you look back in time, it's just one of those inexplicable upsets.
Yeah.
Like, how did they possibly? I mean, it wasn't even close. After winning whatever it was, 110 games or something?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, and you know, and guys in 3 or 4 20-game winners, and how? You know, but that's, again, that's sports when you talk upsets and your unpredictable nature. But that's one of those hows.
Right, that's...
That's for sure. And so he was part of that. So, I you know, it's weird. I mean, I don't know how much preservation of memory there is in Cleveland these days when once they change the name of the team, you know, do away with Indians to Guardians. I know they had a statue of Bob Feller. I haven't been to that ballpark very much. I know they had a statue of Bob Feller, but I don't know what they've done in terms of assimilation of the history of, you know.
Okay.
It took me a good few years to call them the Guardians.
I'm still, you know, not adjusted to that.
Yeah, I mean, I could have a day where I might not either, you know, thinking the same thing. Because it's also in the context of the moment. They were the Indians when they did that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can't tell you which year they became the Guardians, but if you're like writing history, well, when they actually played that, they were the Indians.
Yeah.
So you have to think about it that way. It's like the Gulf of America. Or yeah. Mount McKinley and Denali, whichever right. week it might be.
Yeah.
You know
who you're talking to. Yeah.
Yeah, right. So yeah. Anyway. But it was an interesting group of guys. It was not a powerful hitting team. I mean, you got guys like Luis Aparicio would lead the league in stolen bases 7 years, I think. I mean, he led it all the time. And I think the MVP was Nellie Fox of the league, but it wasn't for home runs. He hit fewer home runs than me, I think. I mean, he wasn't one of those guys. I mean,
yeah.
Al Smith was a very solid outfielder. But again, not a 300 hitter with 30 home runs. And Jim Rivera was the one thing I always remember about Jim Rivera, who was, you remember when Bill Veeck was the owner, and Bill Veeck had the year where he wanted to introduce that kind of period of time of White Sox to wearing shorts.
Oh boy.
As uniforms. And Jim Rivera was one of the guys who modeled the shorts. So I always had this picture in my head of Jim Rivera in White Sox shorts. But that didn't last very long.
That was a horrible look.
I was going to say it was a horrible look and not a great idea.
Yeah.
It did not sing. It did not stick either.
No.
But he was one of those guys from that time period too. You know, a lot of solid ball players. Not so many fabulous hitters. You know, they won 94 games, which wasn't a huge amount, you know, to win the pennant. Again, no playoffs back then.
Right.
And they lost to the Dodgers. So, in the World Series. The first LA World Series.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Funky enough that it was in the Coliseum. Funky enough that the Coliseum is still there and they're going to use it in the Olympics again in 2028.
Yeah.
That building is still going to, I mean, I'm sure it'll be spruced up a bit, but it's got the same building that started with what? The 1932 Summer Olympics.
Yep.
Became the Dodgers home. Set attendance records. The Major League Baseball attendance records were all from people going to games at the Coliseum. And we'll come back around. Now, like over almost 100 years later,
that's
for another
amazing.
Olympics.
Particularly in today's world where stadiums are built and torn down by beloved kingdoms, toast.
Right.
And the citizens of the state of Washington are still paying for that all these years later. But to have a venue like that last for so long and be viable, you know, there are complaints about the restrooms and all that kind of stuff, but still, it's pretty
it
amazing.
UCLA or USC who use it for home football? I can't remember which
one. I think it's USC.
I think it is. Yeah. It was, I know.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah, so they use it all the time. It's not just that it sits there.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it has a tenant, you know, somebody's home field.
Right.
Which is still kind of amazing when you think about it. Yeah. So, so it'll come around again.
So, why do you suppose that when I was looking up for any information about Early Win, I came across your book, and that's really kind of it. Why do you suppose that is? That there isn't more out there about him, because he is the Hall of Famer, 300 game winner. Like you said, that's pretty exclusive, elite crowd. What do you suppose that is? And then this is any sort of expert opinion. I'm just asking because you dig into this stuff
all the
time. I agree,
though. I mean, that's a very legitimate question, and there are a lot of people. And a lot of people like me who write a lot of baseball. And I looked at this as a way to tell this story, but also emphasize Early Win. But you're right that it probably should be a book just on Early Win. And it's unusual when somebody of a certain stature falls through the cracks in baseball more than any other sport. And to prove that, I just finished writing the book like a couple weeks ago, turned it in, of someone who kind of fits the description of somebody we're talking about here, who was very famous in his time, a super Hall of Famer, who was probably on the top 10 list of greatest players ever at his position, not underexposed based on what city he played in, and there was never anything about him. And that is New York Yankees catcher, Hall of Famer, Bill Dickey.
Okay.
It turns out, when I did the research, it was a hell of a challenge to come up with the right amount of material, and that's probably why.
Okay.
This is a guy who, I mean, when you think about it, he accomplished a tremendous amount. He came up at the tail end of Murderer's Row with the Yankees, was teammates with Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig, was the mainstay of the team through the Joe DiMaggio era, actually briefly managed the Yankees, was a longtime coach of the Yankees under Casey Stengel, taught Yogi Berra how to catch. Yogi was a great hitter, but apparently not a good fielder. And he said, one of the great yogiisms that I came across for the book was he learned me all of his knowledge. You know, that kind of, and he tutored Elston Howard, too. He also never opened his mouth, apparently, from all the clips I saw. He never told stories, almost. He never... couldn't find a long, in-depth story about him from his playing days. I think there was one in the Sporting News after he was retired, as far as that went. So the dearth of information in-depth made it the biggest challenge I ever had on a book. So I can only guess that something like that was true of early Wynn. Because okay. I can think of a few other Hall of Famers I've had people suggest to me that I write about. And I think there's less material on them. But don't think he played in New York.
Right, yeah.
So it's like, that's why I said that was making it even more so unlikely. I mean, you're not going to be underexposed in New York. But maybe you're going to be underexposed compared to Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig and Joe DiMaggio and Mickey Mantle in case he's single. Well,
there is that, right?
Yeah, there is that. But I have a vast baseball book library of my own. So I was able to use material, tidbits here, tidbits there, find little Bill Dickey stories, somebody tell. And, of course, there was material at the Baseball Hall of Fame. But compared to what you would think in terms of the volume of material, it was a real challenge. And I suspect maybe that's the same deal with early Wynn. Because I can think, one of the baseball book publishers I work for, we talk about ideas and we throw out names and stuff. And I got this guy who is a reader of mine, who just some guy who got my phone number. We talk like once a year. And he sometimes sends me ideas. And it's just like what you said about early Wynn. He's got a few guys. He said, has there ever been a book on so-and-so? Uh-huh. And I said, you know, on the surface, it looks like there should be. But there isn't as much material as you'd think. So I wrestle with that from a personal standpoint as an author and researcher all the time with your question focused on early Wynn. So that's a long answer, but I mean, I pulled it off, but I was like a deep sigh when I finished on Bill Dickey was, and that it was even harder than I thought when I started. I was a little worried when I started. Mm-hmm. But I said this guy, and using all the same reasons we talked about, how he played New York, you know, and he did not have a checkered career. He spent his whole off-season life in his home of Arkansas. Newspapers.com was a research tool that helped a lot with me searching Arkansas newspapers from his playing days.
Oh, wow.
And that supplemented it, and that helped. And I wonder if such a thing might not be, because he was the favorite son.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was like one of the biggest. I mean, there were other Arkansas well-known players, you know, but he was sort of like out there, and, sure. and everybody cared, like the whole state cared. So mm-hmm. like there would be stories from sources like the wire services when he was playing that might show up in these tiny newspapers in towns in Arkansas that I never heard of that I was able to find. Okay. And that we can thank the internet for. Now, I wonder if such a thing isn't true of Early Wynn in Alabama.
That very well could be.
I don't know that. Did they adopt him like that? You know, without a search, you wouldn't know. But right. but so so there's a few guys, you know, who are famous players. And here's a perfect example of a guy who was a superstar, who had one of the greatest hitting seasons of all time, who is one of those guys in the Hall of Fame, Chuck Klein. You won't find a book on Chuck Klein. And he's one of those guys where I think the amount of research is limited. And also, if they played a long time ago, now Early Wynn is a better bet because he was more modern.
Right.
I mean, when you go way back, reporters didn't even go in the locker rooms after games. So there's no game stories with quotes.
Right.
Like a guy who pitch a no-hitter and there'll be no quote from him.
You get just the box score and maybe a little brief description of the play-by-play, and that's it.
I did a book on Cy Young, and that was true. But the reason Cy Young, of course, I was able to do it. Cy Young lived a long life. He was 88, and he lived into the 50s. So a lot of people wrote about him later.
Right.
But if you're actually looking for contemporaneous material, like after – and he pitched three no-hitters. But you won't find – a quote from Cy Young about that no-hitter,
right.
which, of course, these days, there'd be 50 stories, right?
Yeah,
so there's another contrast, the era we're talking about, you know, because Cy Young retired in, 1910, you know, or something. And mm-hmm. sports writers never went in the locker room then. They didn't right. do post-game interviews like that. So that affects it, too.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the best my theory could give you on Early Wynn. But I still think there might be more there, you know. But I did put a lot of Early Wynn in this book.
Yeah, you did. And
that was on purpose.
Well,
because I figured
appreciate
he was
that.
It was very important, I thought. So,
you know, something that I'm going to have to try and dig through, I think, just from a personal interest. But he wrote a column for the newspaper when he was in Cleveland, right? Early Wynn. Unless I got my wires crossed, I think he had a like once a week kind of deal. But it'd be fun to dig in and read that. But
yeah, some of those things, that's the kind of thing that shows up in the player files in Cooperstown in the research library. And of course, they were probably ghostwritten.
Yeah, of course.
A lot of the guys, you know, but sometimes you get a trove like that because then they're talking. Mm-hmm. And if they wrote it for a few years, I'm trying to think of an example. It wasn't him, but somebody else comes to mind who has in their files like that, like 50 of those they wrote, you know?
Yeah.
And that gives you their thinking of stuff, but of course maybe it wasn't their thinking because it was a ghostwriter. but you know, but I'm sure they talked to him about it at least.
Yeah.
But yeah, once in a while they would have guys do that. And they especially did it going way back in the World Series where they would hire a superstar whose team wasn't in it to write from the World Series. So you could probably find Ty Cobb talking about the World Series, you know, in a column.
Right.
In a Detroit newspaper because they wanted to sell it on his fame.
Sure.
Yeah. So those things exist for certain guys.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about Chuck Klein.
Yeah.
He's one of the guys that comes to mind where I would wish I would like to know more about him. You know? And he did have probably the single greatest hitting season by a member of the Phillies. You know, he's one of those guys with the, I think, who shared the 4 home run record for a game.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
Yeah, you know, he never hit 400, but I think he hit almost 390. And
dang.
That kind of thing.
Yeah.
But for as super as he was nowadays, you know, he'd be there with Aaron Judge and all those attention people.
Sure.
He's not so well remembered either, is he?
No, huh?
As great as he was, and he is in the Hall of Fame, it wasn't like he was overlooked for that.
I'm sure that there, you know, if we wanted to, we could put together a pretty impressive list of those guys.
Right.
And like you said, a lot of it has to do with the time that they're playing and whether or not they were gregarious and talk to people, yeah, or if they were more.
That's a good word to describe the probably the line between publicity and not.
Yeah. Willing to talk or not. So.
Or even being asked.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
well,
they're up to a certain time period.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm not sure when it really changed. Where I know by the 50s, you know, you were getting game stories with quotes from visits to the locker room. But I don't know where it changed in the 30s and 40s.
In today's world, it's almost mandatory. It's like, you know, good old Marshawn Lynch, I'm just here so I don't get fined. They make you go talk to people, right?
Right.
So, but back in the day, that wasn't the case.
And like I said, there were occasions I was amazed by, but then I would be so thrilled when I saw an anecdote.
Yeah.
You know, it was tucked away in the World Series notes from Game 4 from 1932 is this whole little story. Oh, I don't know, 3 inches of type with Bill Dickey, and it was a gem. You know what I mean? So you get excited because it was precious to some of us. So I hope I found all of those, you know. But it was a serious challenge. And I have sometimes hesitated to even propose a project to a company that does baseball for that reason. Like, is there enough there?
Sure.
Can I do it? Can I make it the full, you know, thing? And, you know, he never talked about his family life, Bill Dickey.
Mm.
I mean, it was a baseball biography. I mean, it had so little on his family, even, because there was, of course, it was very trendy at certain times, even for a New York social, the social pages, the women's pages, where a World Series player might have a woman from the society page go interview his wife at a game. And always refer to them as Mrs. Dickey in the story.
Right?
Never used their first name or anything. And I came across one of those, and it actually was useful. But I mean, it was not. But it was rare. It was like it made it seem like, thank God I found this piece of paper. You know, like that. You know, so I think you got to go through the time period too, and how things were reported and dealt with. You know, now it's the era of overkill.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah.
You know, I don't care what color underwear he was wearing when he hit the home run. That's not really pertinent, but
actually, I would have been happy.
Someone probably asked that question.
To tell you the truth, I would have been happy if it said that he was wearing green underwear. Because it would have said
something, right?
Something different, distinctive, and colorful. Yeah, I probably would have seized upon that. So, however, it did not exist.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we talked a bit about your process when you latch on to a project like the early win book, and you have talked about spending time in the Baseball Hall of Fame library. Not to say that there aren't other resources or your own book collection. On a typical project, when you start out, how do you go about gathering all your information? It's a pretty broad question, I know.
It is, but it also, the time element, you know. I mean, look at the contrast where I just mentioned Bill Dickey. Bill Dickey's been dead for 30 years. You know, all his teammates are dead. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to get any firsthand stuff.
Right.
When I did the 1959 White Sox, and Earl Winn had passed away. However, many members of that team were still alive. And I was fortunate enough to be able to reach out to them and get them and talk to them directly, in addition to those other printed sources from the past, whether mm-hmm. they be books or once a month in the way of books on that group. But an old newspaper clippings, the Sporting News, the Sports Illustrated, Sport Magazine. But so in that case, where you got people who are alive, you can set out and try to track them down and talk to them.
Sure.
And that's, you know, and that's helpful. Bill Dickey, again, his name is in everything about Yankees history, useful or not. So at least there's, and you know, the Yankees of those people, those eras, the Babe Ruth. I mean, he was Lou Gehrig's roommate,
right,
on the road, and they were best friends. So that was material that was printed in books through Lou Gehrig, as well as people interviewing when he died and things like that. Mm-hmm. So there were things to be found where Dickey talked about the sad period, where he could see, because he spent so much time with him, he might sense something ahead of other people. I mean, if you were living with a guy in the road, you know, so you can still get it firsthand, even though the people were long dead. But mm-hmm. Again, you're talking very different eras. You know, when I was writing this 15 years ago, many members of that White Sox team were still alive and had lived it firsthand. So to be able to track them down is a huge benefit. You know, I wasn't going to find those people for Bill Dickey because right. they're all gone, you know. And again, you know, and that can affect whether or not you even undertake a project.
Sure.
To see what's realistic. You know, I keep using Chuck Klein as an example. There are other people like that. And, you know, Hall of Famers who have never had their whole life story told. But their contemporaries aren't around either.
Right. The first hand is missing.
I have a book coming out. I was a boxing writer.
Oh, yeah.
With the Philadelphia Inquirer during the last great heyday, catching Sugar Ray Leonard, Thomas Hearns, Roberto Duran, period, Larry Holmes. Mm-hmm. And so I've always been interested in that. And I have a book that I did of Dempsey and Tunney against the backdrop of the Roaring Twenties. And actually, I mean, this, and Dempsey's been written about a lot. Tunney's been written about a lot. But I actually was able to talk to some people who, in the boxing world, who had met them, still, you know. But to me, the most fun I had with that was the backdrop. Roaring Twenties stuff that I researched.
Sure.
That was different from outside the boxing world. And I actually had more fun with that part of it, maybe. But altogether, I thought it worked out well. It hasn't come out yet. That book's not coming out till later in the year.
Looking forward again, to that one, too.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was, again, where the protagonists were dead.
Right.
And I mean, I actually had a piece of cheesecake once at Jack Dempsey's restaurant many years ago, but he wasn't there. However, right. My favorite story for the whole book, and this is the unexpected. There's a well-known boxing promoter who's retired in Philadelphia named Russell Peltz, who's in the Boxing Hall of Fame, who was always a boxing guy, even from the time he was a kid. He used to watch the fights with his father and all this. He's in his 70s now.
Yeah.
And he didn't care who it was, he would watch. But he he once took a road trip in high school from Philadelphia. They took a bus trip to New York City, and they hadn't planned lunch. So he actually managed to convince the chaperone they should eat at Jack Dempsey's restaurant. And lo and behold, they go in there, and Jack Dempsey is there in a corner booth. So yeah. Russell actually goes up to meet him. He gets his picture taken with him. And Russell, 60 years later, Russell still has that photograph on his desk.
That is awesome.
Of him and Jack Dempsey. Yeah. And it was because he was able to push for them to eat there. And Jack Dempsey, I remember, I'm old enough to remember when Jack Dempsey's restaurant was there in Times Square, but even though it's been gone for a long time.
Yeah.
You know. But so, I mean, you still can get a little fortunate with things that have never been told and people who brushed against the people who saw them pitch. Like, you remember the game you saw when you were, what did you say, 11 years old?
Yep. Oh, yeah.
Something like that. You know, you can, you might get lucky with those people. Whatever the sports topic is, since long ago as the, and Dempsey and Tunney is 100 years.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, they fought in 26 and whatever, those 2 years in there. So, if,
well, Jack, you know, Dempsey, but, Jack Dempsey is number six on my all-time Indian All-Stars list of Indian All-Stars, because he's part Cherokee. So
I thought he was a very interesting man. He was uneducated, but learned.
Yes.
Over time, mm-hmm. he absorbed his lumps from being uneducated.
Talk about the school of hard knocks.
And being taken advantage of. Right, right. You know, his manager, who he came to resent and all that, because he, but later in life, I think he was, you know, very much, a good guy to the community and stuff. And Tunney and Dempsey were such different people.
For sure.
Yeah, I mean, they were completely different. But there you go, when you said the Hard Knocks thing. I mean, Dempsey would be a great one for you. The, everything. I'll be happy to talk to you about that someday.
Yeah, let's follow up with that.
I think the tentative release date was August 1st, so I don't know.
Okay.
All I know is it's one of my favorites that I've ever worked on. And one of my favorites, and one of the best, I think. Well, so, but again, a lot of it is the flavor of the times.
Sure.
And this goes to the heart of what, if we're talking about Early Wynn,
mm-hmm.
you know, is Early Wynn a person of the 50s, the 40s and 50s? Because he was in the military.
Mm-hmm.
He missed some time, you know, like a lot of those guys did. So he was really, you know, people who lived at that time, their times were different than people who grow up now.
Definitely.
Can't, you know, I didn't, nope. So if you were to write about Early Wynn, and you're going back to this long-winded answer of why not.
Oh, it's fascinating.
You still have to think, you have to, hopefully you could find Alabama stuff.
Sure.
That would help round him out as his youth,
right?
You know, before he turned pro,
because
everything else after that will be documented,
right?
You know,
and retelling what's already been there. But what about the foundation? What about the,
yeah,
like you said, the early stuff?
And what shapes the person?
Yeah,
why was it? And what, you know, like, why was he throwing at his grandmother?
Yeah. Yeah.
Was she a bad woman?
where did that come from? Where did that right, steel right. or that hardness
Early
Wynn, come from?
Early, who actually liked his grandmother's cooking, would never have hesitated to put her on her butt. There's a line from the book that doesn't exist.
Right. There you go.
Yeah.
That's a start, right?
Right. Right. Yeah. That could be the first sentence. Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, so, you know, there's a completely different example on the research with the Bill Dickey thing.
Sure.
And it's very fresh for me because I just finished a couple weeks ago. So, but it was hard.
Yeah.
Nobody says it's going to be easy all the time. And then I've heard too, there's no Lou Brock book.
Really?
Yeah. And I've heard from someone who knew him, who I know in St. Louis, there's all this fractionalism in family that might prevent a smooth book going forward.
Well, that's a shame.
Because there's different sides and whatever. So there's a reason that maybe for, I think there might have been like a, when he was playing, there might have been a quickie book. Other than that, I don't, there's no real biography. So, but I mean, and I only heard that secondhand, you know. I do know that that was 2 years ago. There's still no Lou Brock book, and I've never heard of one being in. And that might be what's going on. The surviving
that's not
relatives.
Something you want to tackle, right?
No, I don't want to get involved with the family who's not going to be in agreement about stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, boy, that's a shame.
I mean, that was the context of how it came up, because this was the guy who knew the family.
Okay.
Brought it up. And he was actually recommending against it at the time, saying, let them all sort their things out.
Sure.
So, but I would have been interested, you know, because he's a cool guy.
Crazy roadblocks and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, you can't have that.
Yeah.
It's not like it's going to make a ton of money. So people might have the delusion that it's riches.
Right.
It's not. So.
So, well, I won't ask you about the remuneration from all of your efforts, but I will say, I would like to ask this. How long does it take? And after 70, 75 books, however many you've written, like a rough average, does it take 6 months to put something together, a year and a half, or can you even say? Sometimes it's probably
you can't even say. Everything's different. Number one, and because I still write for newspaper, I don't write full time. But, you know, when I was working full time, you know, I'm at work 60 hours a week. So that's going to affect your production.
Sure, absolutely.
You know, and your time.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, right now I only work up to 20. And so combine the books and the newspapers full time. I guess you could say my writing and all. So, you know, I'm pretty good at buckling down, you know, of setting aside time. Mm-hmm. So it's, I'm not one of those people that would sit there and, have you ever heard about writer's block? You know, it's not been an issue. And I try to be pretty organized. So I know where I'm going next when I leave off one day.
Mm-hmm.
That's the best, when you finish a chapter and you know, and then you got 2 days where you're going to go off and cover a basketball tournament and be out of touch and not even, and then, but you know where you're going to pick up. Even if it's 2 or 3 days later, mentally, it's so much easier.
Yeah.
Now, sometimes when I finish, I should be writing something now that I'm not, because I just got over the Bill Dickey thing and I want to put a little space between it.
Let it breathe for a minute.
Yeah, let me breathe.
Yeah, right.
You know, and I covered a college basketball season, and but my teams are all gone now. So now it's just this weekend, I'm just going to watch. So I'm not going to write. I'm just going to watch the Final Fours of the men and the women. And then it's time to start writing, maybe, because I'll have, you know, to get going.
Okay.
To say, okay, nothing's in the way mentally. That's, but so sometimes you could speed along and surprise yourself, and other times it'll take longer. So I really can't ever, you know, people do ask that question, but I can't ever really give a specific answer.
That makes sense.
They're all different. They're all different. And they're not all the same length. They're all not all the same length.
Sure.
You know, and were you a Bob Uecker fan?
Oh, of course.
Yeah. Well, I did a quickie book on Bob Uecker. That's coming out any minute.
Okay.
I when he died, I just said to one of my publishers, I said, you know, somebody should put together a collection of all his best sayings, not a real biography, but include his career and the highlights, but all his sayings, and there's zillions of them out there.
Yeah.
And they said, you want to do it? So like it happened like that. It was like, bam, bam. And it was like, how fast can you do it? That's really because it's a fresh news thing.
Sure. Yeah.
So that's a rarity. Whereas Bill Dickey could come out in 2 years, this will be out in 2 weeks, maybe. I don't know. I mean, very unusual circumstance for me, too, to do something like that.
Okay.
And well, it just hit
there
me.
Again, there's plenty of
and
material.
And it's funny. I will tell you it's funny.
Okay.
Because he was a very funny man. I consider him to be the funniest man in the history of baseball. I'm not sure Early Wynn was.
Yeah.
He's not known for his stand-up
routine.
Doesn't
sound like. Doesn't sound like. And,
no. No. But Bob Uecker, actually, I think he did try some stand-up. A little bit.
Well, if he would have stuck with it, he probably would have been pretty good. But because
I think he was funny everywhere he went.
Yeah.
He was on The Tonight Show like over 100 times?
No, I didn't know that.
That's nuts.
That's
right?
crazy.
Yeah. I mean, they ended up giving him, he was a fill-in host, I think, eventually, sometime. I mean, I know.
When I saw the news that he passed, it's like, boy, there goes the lighthearted heart of baseball right there. That's
exactly.
That's a shame.
Everybody loved Bob Uecker.
Yeah.
And I don't blame him. I only met him a couple times in press boxes. But, I mean, I read his book, and that's over 40 years old. And just typical Bob. And we all know about J.D. Salinger and Catcher in the Rye. So the name of Bob, was Bob's book was Catcher in the Rye, W-R-Y.
That's
you
great.
Know? You know, I mean, and you can just Google it.
Sure.
And find one liner after one liner. He was such a funny man.
Yeah.
Just brilliant. I mean, the kind of wit he had. So there's the complete opposite. It'll probably end up being the fastest book I ever wrote in my life.
Okay.
Well, and it's because of the circumstances.
We got Bill Dickey on the one hand, where you can't find anything, and Bob Uecker, where you can find everything at your fingertips.
Bang. Just about enough.
Yeah, yeah.
And I like I said, and that was the way, and I think he'll should see it soon.
Okay.
That's the whole point.
Well, another one that we'll look forward to.
But I mean, it's like, again, but such a contrast in the experience of writing, like reading whole books as research.
Sure.
You know, like as background, you know, and picking up a 500-page Lou Gehrig book, looking for Bill Dickey in the index.
Right.
And that's the same thing that you would do with Early Wynn on it. Like if you had a Bob Feller book.
Right.
Look for Early Wynn.
There's got to be something in there.
I agree, you know, from your standpoint and your perspective, I wish I knew a little bit more about his Native American connections. You know, like that. It's not always as clear as Jim Thorpe. It's not always as clear as the other thing we had chatted about with something as pure as the Native American games in Alaska, that the World Eskimo Indian Olympics. And the name is there.
Right. It's part of
it's not the same if it's just one. I mean, I had grandmother from Ireland. Am I Irish? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's a grandfather from England and two other grandparents from Russia. So I don't know what that makes me. Right.
Right. Right. And, you know, part of that is personal, but part of it is with the whole Native American or Indian thing. Part of that was from the government standpoint about whether you are or not. But that's a whole different topic. But back in the day, even in, Early Wynn's formative years and everything, it wasn't very cool to be Indian at that point. It was
right.
And so for there potentially to be not a whole lot spoken about it, in his past. Even if we were to dig in, that wouldn't be surprising. But that's some of that is the stuff that I want to try and find out and talk to people about to find out a little bit more about, because part of my my reason for doing this whole thing is to provide I don't want to say a resource, that sounds a little too officious, but tell stories about people that came from situations like the kids that I see in school every day. About half of my students are Native American here with the Colville Reservation right here. And so kids that I see every day.
I hope they watch your show.
Well, I give them the opportunity. I don't force them.
I was going to say, is it homework?
there's an idea. Actually, I'm proposing a podcasting class for next year. And so it will be required homework at that point. Is that self-serving or?
I think it sounds useful to me.
Okay. Well, thank you for spinning that the positive way.
Yes.
Anyway, I want to provide them with some, I guess, some role models or to show that people that
absolutely
started out just like them can do great things. And
absolutely.
And so that's
perfect.
That's,
perfect description.
That's really what this is kind of all about. So.
Anyway. And as well as history and heritage.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. All of it. You know, that guy behind you on the wall, Jim Thorpe, is no better example, no bigger one in American history.
Yeah, for
who's
sure.
Who's underneath him?
That's a guy, MMA fighter, Dan Henderson.
Okay. That's one sport I don't follow. I did not make the transference from boxing to MMA.
Yeah. It took me a while to kind of because I was a huge boxing fan growing up, and when that first came out, it was like, oh boy, I don't know, but
I don't think I ever got past it.
Yeah, that's all right. That's all right.
What can I tell you?
Yeah,
so, I know the people at the Boxing Hall of Fame in New York, and I, you know, and I had a nice run as a boxing writer, written a few good boxing books, and. But not the same to me.
So I have a...
It was always the people.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the story, right? I mean, everybody
it's always
can watch
the people.
Fight, but it's the right. People that make the story.
You know, and when if you were a writer, and it's just like with baseball, you know, you go to the game 3 hours before and you talk to the guys in the locker room and then you catch them at the end. But that's the time spent. That's special, and where you get to chat with people and know them and do more in-depth things with them. And that was certainly true with boxers in the training camps leading up to the fights. Sure, the, you know, the glitter and the glamour and the big money and the TV was the culmination. But, you know, when you're watching them jump rope and they're talking after that and stuff, that's when it's more interesting. It was more interesting.
Yeah.
So
I can totally see that.
Yep.
I have a thing that I, you know, my social media posts on this date in Indian All Stars.
Are we
history.
Running over here?
Oh no! I like I said, I bucked up and got the unlimited time. But thanks for keeping an eye out.
Yeah, well, I wasn't keeping an eye. Oh, man.
I have a thing where I say, I have a post on this date in Indian All-Stars history, and it goes through and lists a bunch of things that happened on that calendar day, for whatever, and, you know, Facebook and Instagram and all that stuff it does. My wife pointed out at one point that there's a heck of a lot of boxing. Why is there so much boxing? So, well, because I think that was documented a lot better. And, you know the exact date of everything that happened. But part of that is because it's probably easier to find. You can find the guys' boxing records online and has the date and the results.
It used to be, but it's much better now.
Yeah.
I mean, it used to be, remember the ring record book?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, well, now it's all online.
Right. That's the thing, is that I can find that quick. It's hard to find out what Johnny Bench did on August 11th in 1972.
Actually, it's not. You can. But if you don't know the date is where it's hard.
Yeah.
If you know the date, you can find it.
Yeah.
If you don't know the date, you're flailing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, because you can't go through each at the, you know, the baseball reference or whatever, go through each date and read everybody's stats.
Well, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But that's why I said that if you know the date, you can get it.
Yep. So anyway,
this would interest you, and I haven't talked about it in a long time, but it's been five more years since I discussed this with the company. I'm doing a book on the Native American in Major League Baseball from the earliest days through the present day. And it kind of got put aside. We not talked about it for several years, but I wish there was there's a lot of interesting guys who could be a chapter in it.
There certainly are.
Yeah, I mean, so anyway, I just want to mention it because it would be certainly something that would be, relevant to you.
Yeah, if I had the talent and the wherewithal to pull that together, I think that would be a great project. But that's beyond my purview. But somebody should do
take
that
some time.
I think it would be a fabulous project. I mean,
I have too many ideas and not enough time, and not enough people in the tougher world of publishing these days than ever to do business with, which doesn't help either. So sometimes I easily, I just slid into the Euchre thing. That was totally unanticipated one day and a reality the next. I mean, just completely unlike, a long time talking with ideas and throwing them out there and said, oh yeah, let's do it. And boom. But that's definitely an aberration. Otherwise, I might be having to think. I mean, I have, and certain people, of course, if I'm dealing with, they don't want to do more than one thing a year. And I might have seven things that would fit for them. And they might not even do it. But I mean, it might be that it takes years to get something done.
Sure.
I remember one of my favorite books that I've ever done. And this is a good one for, because I've always looked for good stories where that involve minority breakthroughs. And Loyola University men's basketball team won the NCAA title in 1963. They also did it with four African-American starters at a time where where coaches would get harangued if they used more than two. I mean, the coach got hate mail, death threats for that and stuff. And I was in Chicago and I got to meet a lot of those guys at an event. Okay. And we started talking. I did a magazine story for Basketball Times. And I said, this could be a book, blah, blah, blah. It took me 10 years. I wrote the magazine story on the 40th anniversary and a book came out on the 50th.
Oh my.
I mean, clearly not planned, but that just shows you how things can happen. And sometimes things that look like they're dead in the water could come back to life.
Sure.
Yeah. And I'm so happy I did that book. I mean, it's one of my favorite things I've ever done. Most meaningful. I know. And indeed, this is another case like the White Sox book, where since that book came out, several of those guys have passed away.
Hmm.
So they got to see it. And
Oh, that's got to be a little personal rewarding for you, is it?
Yeah. And then they started dying.
Yeah.
You know what
That's
I mean?
tough.
And again, they're not because they were young. I mean, they weren't. It wasn't like a plague. It wasn't because they were flukes. It was age.
Right.
It was literally just the
Just
normal
as
course
the
of
time.
events.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was one that was special in that way, too. So anything else on early? Are we done?
Yeah, no,
Have we
I think
filled up our time?
Just about. I do have one other question. I told you I'm not Dan Rather earlier, right? But
Whatever.
I did swipe one thing from his big interview show that I really enjoyed watching when he was doing it. His last question to all of his guests was, "Is there anything that I didn't ask you that you wish I would have or that I should have asked you?"
I've hardly ever thought that or been asked that, actually.
That's why I like it.
But I think, I can't. I mean, this book would not have existed without Early Win. Hence, that's why the title. As much as it was a team deal and, team achievement. And that was their first pennant in 40 years since the Black Sox
The
scandal.
Black Sox, yeah.
Yeah, because that team went into a super tailspin from being one of the best teams in baseball to being awful. It was like cosmic punishment, that they would be bad forever. So it was 40 years before they won a pennant, but even though that's not really a big part of this. But to me, the crux of the whole thing, and it was Early Win. And it was because of some of the things we've talked about today. I really admired his career. I liked that he won the 300 games, and he persevered to get it, and that he was the best pitcher in the American League when he was that old. I mean, all of those things appealed to me as essentially he put the team on his shoulders and I put the book on his shoulders. You could say that.
Okay.
So he was the main character in that sense, and I will always think of that book that way, even though I never got a chance to meet him, and I did get a chance to meet and chat with and had joy speaking with several of the other guys.
Well, I'm envious of that experience. That would have been pretty cool. I know that when my neighbor Earl Torgerson, when he passed away, I think it was 1990. A lot of his baseball cronies came to the service, so I got to meet a few of them.
Okay,
and
good.
And that's not really the slap on the back and talk about their careers kind of times,
Right.
But they were. They were gracious and talked to us kids and all that kind of stuff, and it was pretty neat.
That is, yeah, and that would be. I never, when I was a kid, I never met anybody like that. I mean, the New York World's Fair. There are a few basketball stars or something signing autographs that I got autographs, and I think
okay.
I still have them in a box. But
excellent.
I mean, not really ever things like that.
Uh-huh.
Never knew anybody who was a major leaguer or anything like that, as a kid.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you again for taking the time, and I look forward to chatting with you again. You brought up a few extra things that I think
sure.
we might be able to
anytime.
Talk about. Anytime
we can work it out with our mutual schedules, and
excellent.
I will send you an email and I will tell Nicole Johnson about you.
Okay, I appreciate it, sir.
In an email.
Again, thanks, and I look forward to the next one.
Thank you.
All
Take
right,
care.
Lou. Have a
good
good
luck
day.
on
We'll
the show.
Thanks a lot.
Okay.
I appreciate it. Take care.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman. aka the Football History Dude, and I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history, but as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know, that can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you gotta do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you gotta do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.